to be or not to be. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and by opposing end them, to die no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache. My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segredo Show. Sometimes it's important to ask ourselves what we leave out when we're telling a story. If we drop a few words or insert a few tonal ellipses, how does the story change? How can we speculate, prognosticate, offer any kind of aid to give back the world if we...
Over. Finished. Finito, baby. I've packed my suitcases. Here's my half of the rent. I'll be drinking in the motel if you need me. Here's my suicide note.
You see what we did there? Examine the holes of expression and new stories form. It's all part of the human impulse to speculate. Now, Jenny Offal explores this idea in her new novel, Department of Speculation. It's a book about a woman in early middle age who seems to have a meaningful family. Or does she? As the novel progresses, we learn this woman, referred to only as the wife, is hiding many details from us, and many details from herself. Or is she? You see, the story is told in breezy paragraphs, but there's all these ellipses that will have you hunting and speculating and... Yeah, the cliched monologue about the end of the relationship. I mean, can you believe the dialogue this hack writer gave me? No, Charles. I don't think I'm going to take it. Okay, so I am here with Jenny Offal, who is most recently the author of Department of Speculation. Jenny, how are you doing?
Great to be here.
So anyway, I want to go ahead and start off with a very elaborate question I don't think anybody else has actually touched upon, but I feel compelled to. One of the first things I noticed in this book, and it's there from the very opening epigraph, is the ellipses. You know, you have, you know, this is definitely one of those books where close reading is greatly rewarded. And I was fascinated by how you used ellipses to leave out very pivotal parts of quotes. Just to offer one example, you have the epigraph from Socrates, "Speculators on the universe, ... are no better than madmen." But the words between the dots that you leave out are, "and on the laws of the heavenly bodies," which is interesting because that's cosmological, and you also explore that later in the book. I also noticed later in the book that you have this Edison quote, which I believe you plucked from Gabby Wood's Living Dolls, A Magical History of the Quest for Mechanical Life, because the ellipses actually match the exact same citation that Gabby
Wood did.
That is
where it's from.
Okay, fantastic. So anyway, just to start off here, I mean, we are pressed in our life right now to confine our instant thoughts to 140 characters, to go ahead and submit to the dreadful binary of plus one and Facebook liking and all that nonsense. So, I mean, I'm wondering how you arrived at the ellipses as a way of reckoning with what we leave out and how what we leave out actually tells a story. And, you know, how do you think these dropped phases can possibly combat the digital reductionist age that we have to suffer in right now?
Oh my gosh, what an amazing question. I think that I've always been interested in, as a writer, in compression. Yeah. And in how much you can distill in a small space. And so an ellipsis is one of those ways to create either a pause, like you might have a breath, yeah, in a poetry line, or also that trailing off feeling.
Sure.
Like there's a moment in the book where the character says, "I was expecting to have the crack up with the headscarf and the people speaking kindly of my funeral." And then it says, "Oh, wait, might still get that one." Yeah. It trails off. And it's because it's meant to kind of capture that feeling of thought where you get halfway through a thought and then you kind of stop. And I feel like instead of what we think of as the kind of digital version of compression, which is about pithiness and, you know, sound bites and like more like kind of thing, something that was more about when our thoughts hesitate and our words follow. That's what I was trying to capture.
In a weird way, it almost responds to the subtweet where you are talking about someone without really talking about someone, except that actually ends up becoming more vulgar and not as interesting as, say, just leaving something out, which is the ultimate way of responding to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, okay, so the wife, I'm going to call her the wife because she's the unnamed protagonist of this novel. She has this very unusual relationship with John Keats. Keats, he informs her concern for death and dread, I think. I mean, her insistence that she is a part of a minority that experiences permanent anguish as opposed to the majority that experiences temporary anguish. There's that distinction. But I caught the Keats thing because we first see this when she cites the words on Keats' tombstone, here lies one whose name was written water, without actually naming Keats. then she claims later on, and this was amazing, she claims that Keats said, no such thing as the world becoming an easy place to save your soul in. I have done a thorough search. I have not found that quote from Keats. I did start to catch on, anytime that Jenny actually says what X said, colon, it's not true for a large chunk of the book. And I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, you know, Keats emboldens the wife to invent these further quotes, including one from Simon Weil, which Meg Wolitzer on NPR actually thought was true, but it was not. I'm wondering, what was it about Keats that triggered this particular impulse to invent quotes for this character?
I think that he's always been a sort of romantic ideal for most writers, and the part where at least a certain type of writer. And that line about your gravestone being writ in water, I think for anyone who's thinking, why am I doing this? This isn't going to last. This isn't anything. It seems to have some kind of resonance. As for the other one, I do believe that I had a citation for it, but I also meant for the ones that say what so-and-so said to be that it's been filtered through her mind and slightly changed.
Yes.
So that may be why it was hard to Google. We did sort of extensively fact check the quotes. I had to go through and like give citations for all of them. Yeah. So I could probably pull that out somewhere. But yes, it was. I noticed that even people who are far more eloquent than I am, I somehow had managed to take a word out or add a word. It was almost that controlling writer impulse where you want to change rhythms and change everything to sound right to your ear. But
well, on the other hand, I mean, there's a certain kind of fluidity in taking quotes and putting them into other people's mouths and changing one word and then actually frustrating the obsessive reader type like me because I can't quite find the exactness. I mean, maybe this is also part of the problem here of having to scavenge from the guts of what has gone before in order to find new forms of expression in order to actually come to terms with what we leave out of our stories.
Right.
Huh.
Well, I like I like writers like David Markson, and I like the way that he brings in those small literary anecdotes. And you also find if you go through his books that
some of them are not true. Yeah,
yeah, a lot of them are not true. In fact, someone, I think it was Blake Butler, did a kind of hilarious thing recently that was literary rumors.
Yes,
it was. They were all just like really, really absurd. And so I think that kind of, I want to call it like the pattern-making part of our brain. It makes over even something that seems like it should be complete and puts it into the pattern of the world as that character sees it.
Do you think we have a certain obligation to resist the canon or to resist the cultural conditioning that we are inevitably going to take in when we read all sorts of books and we memorize quotes and we memorize poems and we use that as a kind of a reference for our lives? I mean, inevitably, we're going to have to resist that, I think, to find some original form of expression. What are your thoughts on this? And is this book in some sense a solution to that?
I thought a lot about that because I was wondering if I should include quotes at all.
Yeah.
And I certainly thought about not having any of them in there. Not least of which because it's hard to put your own writing next to some of the people that I was quoting. But I also felt like I was trying, and whether I succeeded is really more for the reader to say, but I was trying to make a form that felt modern and new to me. And so the feeling of having those quotes as kind of springboards into other thoughts, I do think you always have to kind of go against and have a contrarian impulse to what's been made before.
Yeah.
And that's how you make new things, and that's how you kind of startle and surprise yourself as a writer.
Maybe another way to approach this question is to ask you how you as the author and you as the character work together to mangle quotes in a very interesting way. I mean, you know, did you find that the vicarious
you're starting to worry me. How many did I mangle? You must have written
down. No. I actually love the fact that some are mangled and some are unfindable. But I'm wondering, you know, especially because you had mentioned the fact checking earlier. I mean, I think writers have a duty to bust shit up.
Yeah.
So the question I have is, you know, how much of the tossing rocks through windows came from the character and came from you? And how did you work together to ensure that there was a certain kind of nihilism
that
was healthy for this?
Well, I definitely wanted to create in the character of the wife someone who was bolder and a little more fuck you and fuck things up than I am in my life. I'm much more timid creature. So that kind of...
Which is why you're holding the knife right now.
That's why I'm holding a knife to your throat and making sure that you start to praise the book really soon. But I do sort of feel like...
Can I just give you $20 instead? Maybe $100?
Are you kidding? Yeah, I'm done. I'll take $20. Right. But one of the things I think that in terms of like destroying forms that have come before, I mean, I think that if you don't at least want to do that, then you're just following and imitating. And I've never been interested... In just doing that. And in fact, I one of the ways that my contrarian streak kind of comes out is that I tend to write, both of my novels are books that if someone described those books to me, I'd be like, oh, I'd never read that book.
Yeah.
That sounds awful to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't like books from the point of view of a child narrator. I don't like books about marriage and parenthood. But
motherhood itself is a great stigma as well.
Right, huge. Yeah. I feel like
no one wants to talk about
easily
it.
Easily trivialized. Yeah. And indeed, I had to like make sure they didn't put a line of laundry blowing in the wind on the cover.
Well, there is a laundromat. So
yeah,
there is
a laundromat.
You came very close there.
where they watch out the bed bugs.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I wanted to see if the kind of so-called domestic novel could be forced into contact with a more classic like novel of ideas or philosophical novel.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, I didn't want to bring up the mommy wars, really. I didn't want to get too much into that.
I don't know too much about them.
Well, you know, the whole online op-ed skirmish between moms who stay at home and moms who work and whether one is more virtuous than the other. And, of course, it causes all sorts of fractiousness and lack of unity among motherhood and among actually allowing other people to understand just how time-consuming motherhood is.
Right.
I'm wondering if you feel, with this fragmentary approach, that an issue that is almost verboten, like motherhood, or an issue that nobody wants to discuss, might almost be discussable if we express it in a different way. Would you say that that is the case with this book and that is the case with other subjects you have pursued? Or?
I think that's a good way to think of it. I mean, I think part of the fractured quality of the book is to capture that it's harder in the early years to have thought in the sustained way. Because there, my friend calls it, you know, being pecked to death by little birds. There's a lot of little moments of being asked for things. And also there's moments that you just kind of fall into a different world, a world that's not in your head. And it's a world of the body. And it's actually really fascinating to someone like me and kind of exhilarating. But in terms of what the whole mommy wars thing is, I think what always depressed me about the way people talk about motherhood is that it always gets framed in terms of ambivalence. And I just don't think that ambivalence seems the right word to me. I think it's more about being conflicted. It's about feeling that one part of your life, and for me that would be, you know, my identifying as a writer and as an artist, doesn't fit well into this new incredibly important part of your life. And there seems to be this just falling off a cliff that people don't want to acknowledge. So I just wish that people could talk about it in a more capacious way. I do have a theory that it's just that women have an incredibly superstitious feeling that if they say anything negative about, or even just like, this is hard, that God they're not even sure they believe in might just be like, oh, you don't want to be a mother anymore?
Yeah.
Done. And I feel it too. It's like, it feels scary to say anything, as if some primitive curse will fall upon you.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because I wanted to actually get into the spirituality of this book, which is very interestingly secular. you know, Richard Powers has put forth this idea that the last act of secular prayer is reading.
Mm. I like that.
And the wife's spirituality is actually quite interesting on this point because she is constantly looking up at the heavens, whether it be the apartment upstairs with the speed freaks and the people moving in and out, the constant rotation of roommates, or, in fact, space. Mm-hmm. And she works, of course, at a magazine, a science magazine. She's a fact checker. And she is, of course, dealing with space and thinks about Carl Sagan and all that. You have one moment also where the wife's mother is actually pleased by this view of Jesus that is outside the apartment window.
Actually the husband's mother.
Oh, the husband's mother. I'm sorry. But it's interesting that you have been very strict in keeping the wife's journey secular. And I wanted to ask, you know, why is this? Do you feel that that this kind of taps into what we were talking about earlier in terms of motherhood being this thing you have to embrace with all these fraught perils and all that? I mean, I'm curious.
Well, I mean, I think that I don't entirely think of the wife's thoughts as secular exactly. I think that she's interested in transcendence, and she's interested in mystical strains of thought, and especially interested in the sublime, which she finds also in many moments with her daughter. Many of those smaller moments in the book are meant to be really almost religious to her. But I think it's quite hard to talk about those moments when they happen with children because they don't transfer very easily. I think they sound sort of cheapened when you talk about them to someone that's not their kid. But she's very drawn to, she's basically like a wannabe Buddhist, a fake Buddhist. And so she's drawn to that philosophy because it's a lot like what she knows about writing. The whole continuum of experience is of interest. In fact, really everything is interesting.
Yeah.
And nothing is to be avoided exactly. Everything is to be sort of gone towards because the difficult can be the most interesting thing.
I've alluded to the missing moments in this book, but there is also this strange exploratory impulse as well, the Yuri Gagarin quotes, the Edison quote I had mentioned earlier. There's this tension between exploring and leaving out. And I'm wondering which of these came first and how the two were informed by each other.
First came this sort of gathering of I have a bit of a magpie approach.
Yeah.
A shiny thing. I will take this shiny thing and then later I will build a nest around it. So I had a lot of a lot of the little stories in there, the anecdotes and the bits about evolutionary biology and stoicism and things like that. And then it did occur to me at a certain point that there was no plot or story of any sort. And because I was resisting so much at being about marriage, especially having an affair in it, because I just thought that was so familiar and boring, it took me a long time to decide how I wanted to give the book some emotional velocity. Because I don't think plot is very important, but I think emotional velocity is something that I look for in a book. So that was then it turned into that more, I have all these things and now I want to see how much of this can be taken out and still retain something that felt essential to me. So gathering and then pruning down.
Well, that's interesting because I do know that you have said that there was a book before this that you essentially got in there with the scalpel and took all the guts out and took the shiny bits out.
Yeah.
And,
shiny by the end.
I'm really curious about what the form of this previous novel was, especially since it seems to be, based off of some preliminary research, very plot-driven, very traditional narrative. What worked from that, and what were you trying to explore in that first one that you could in this?
I think it was just sort of second novel trap, where you think, maybe I need to do something very different. And which, in my case, I thought, well, I don't want to write in first person again. I'm going to show that I actually can create some kind of plot. I'm going to bring in all these things from the larger world so people won't just think I'm a small-minded, self-obsessed person. And so it ended up having the part that were the seeds that came up. It was about a second marriage and a woman who'd married her professor.
Yeah.
And she'd been kind of a prodigy. And so it was kind of about that weird moment in life where you've just outrun your precociousness. And we've all maybe known people or been there ourselves. And she had this incredibly grandiose idea that she was going to create a compendium of consciousness that was going to hold every state of consciousness ever recorded by man. She was defeated by this.
Sounds very Borgian.
Yeah, it was. And so the book was in one hand quite linear and regular. And then on the other hand had this crazy book within a book that also the stepdaughter was in this movement about voluntary human extinction. So there was all a lot of things about that too. And I could never get it not to feel uneven because I think I was past being interested in that kind of linear structure.
Ah, yes.
So I was doodling a lot in the margins, and then I was doodling more, and then I was doodling more, and I realized, like, I just don't want to build these bridges to the next scene. Like, I want to leap, you know? Yeah. I just want to leap. And I realized that all the books that I like and the things that I read, a lot of them are, they're very bold in how they move through time and space.
Was this a case where you actually changed too fast for the manuscript you were working on in, like, in your life? Something like
I think that, you know, I actually had two books. You know, yeah. One was about Tesla, and then I discovered someone else was writing truly the exact same book, and I had to abandon that one after 3 years.
Oh, Samantha
years.
Hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, she wrote
Which
a,
is
great,
a great book.
Great book.
Yeah.
So that part was fine, ultimately, although originally it was, of course, terrible. But so that was going to be about Tesla and how he fell in love with a pigeon, which was going to be a fun, easy story to write. But then this one. So I'd already done 3 years on that one, and then I'd done about 4 on this one. And yeah, I was changing. And I think, to be honest, I was just trying to get up the nerve to write the book that I wanted to write. And because I had had a kid, and because I was dealing with some other things in my extended family and some sickness and stuff, I had very little time to write. And people kept telling me, you know what you need to do? You need to write this draft all the way through and then go back.
Yeah.
I don't write like that.
Yeah.
And even though it was really nice for people to try to help me that way, it was a disaster for me because I write sort of sentence by sentence, and when it's done, it's done. But I have to like figure out from the language what happens next. So that was how it got, it just became something that I couldn't figure out how to bring it back into what I wanted it to be. And that's when I just tore it up. And I think I probably kept, you know, 10% of it. And that went on note cards. And then I made this whole other thing, which I was much more excited about, but I actually thought would have extremely limited audience. But that was fine with me. I actually came out of my study and said to my husband, okay, I just tore the whole book apart. I'm going to sell it maybe for $1,000 and a pen. Hope that's cool. I'll write some more kids' books and, you know, I'll go get another job. He's like, all right, cool, hon. So it was a huge surprise.
A little bit of a bizarro wife thing going on here, too.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It sounds very much like the process of having this meat that you're slicing into pounds, and you had to put things in the napkin. Just
right,
yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Odd reference for people who haven't read the book.
Oh, yeah, I know.
That's funny.
And it sounds, the way that she describes it, vaguely criminal, even though it's actually something that a lot of people do.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted in those early scenes to capture that kind of extreme self-consciousness.
Yeah.
And I just wanted it to be, because it's very funny in retrospect to think about. I see it often with my students in their 20s, you know, who are going to be writers. I mean, just the unbelievable self-consciousness. And I had it too, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And I just thought I wanted to have a scene that showed that.
Huh. Well, it's interesting because her self-consciousness changes over the course of the book as she becomes more aware of possibilities,
mm-hmm.
more aware of activities that she can do.
Right.
Of all sorts. And as actually the novel itself moves further away from the city. And I'm wondering about the risk of displaying self-consciousness. How did you find the balance between how much, I suppose, solipsism
mm-hmm.
that the wife actually had to convey and how much she hid from the reader? You know, how did you arrive at that, you know, balance that just sort of gradually has this attrition as the novel carries on?
Right. Well, I felt like it was easy to make the mistake of having this just be completely claustrophobic.
Yeah.
I call it the imitative fallacy. I mean, you can try to write about a depressed person, but if you make it so depressing and that you too, as the reader, are in that black hole, then you failed, really.
Yes.
So for me, it was about bringing in the kind of deadpan humor. And, you know, the wife really never loses her sense of humor, even at the worst moments. So it was, for me, it was very much about that balance. And also a little bit about moments where it kind of blazes into beauty for a moment. I was thinking a lot, in a lot of ways, the book that was the model for me was Jesus's Son.
Huh.
In fact, my joke when I was writing it was that I was trying to write Jesus's Son minus the heroine, plus marriage and kid. And it was because of those swings that he does
yeah.
Between despair and then just kind of exaltation and then back again. And they often happen even within a sentence.
Yeah.
So for me, it was about creating tension within the language itself to give the reader a break from that obsessive self-consciousness.
Short paragraphs help that as well.
Right, right.
Well, that's interesting because for me, I was pretty certain that John Berryman's
Dream Songs was huge.
There are many Berryman quotes pulled from that massive volume, and they're more accurate after a pivotal thing happens, and she becomes more explicit in her quoting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an interesting choice because the wife in your book has much in common with Henry, the figure in the Dream Songs. Both are in early middle age.
Right.
Both shift between first person and third person.
Right.
I'm wondering, did the Dream Songs permit you a certain kind of freedom in depicting the edge of marriage, the work-life balance, motherhood, and all that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious.
I love that book. I think I read it when I was 19, and I've read it many times since. It's just a book that is one of those possibility books that just opened up a lot of different ideas about how to write to me. I tend to read a lot of poetry, maybe. You know, a lot of fiction writers aren't that interested in it, but I find that it's almost like just a shot in the arm of language and of structural possibilities. So, and that line from, I'm going to misquote it, so don't.
It's okay.
Don't get me.
Ellipses, ellipses, ellipses.
Ellipses, ellipses, you know, but I think I walk around at least, you know, once a month and think, life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. You know, there's just something about the way that he broke lines and the way that he, and also that it's a suicidal character.
Yeah.
And that's something that comes to play in the book. You know, the idea of if you have that kind of brain, one of the things that, you know, nobody's really picked up on the book, but to me is important is that I think of the book, yes, it's about marriage. Yes, it's about motherhood. But to me, it's really about loneliness and how you feel that when you're alone, but also, even when you're with another person, that comes back. And so at one point, when she's somewhere beautiful early in the book and she says, I wondered if I lived here, would it fix my brain? I think the whole book is really about, would it fix my brain? And so John Berryman, I think also, there's this constant searching of like, what might make me be able to be in the world as awake as I am, but not feeling like I have no skin on me.
Interesting. I actually wanted to bring up another author. I mean, I know other people, I think, are going to probably compare this book to Renata Adler's Speedboat.
Mm-hmm.
But to my mind, it actually reminded me very much of Janet Malcolm's work.
Mm, interesting.
In the sense that the size is similar, the concerns for how facts line up and form a narrative are very similar, and also very highly anal at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also some of the topics, the Freud reference with civilization and its discontents, the mutability of facts in the Andrewian Carl Sagan story. And I'm wondering, you know, did nonfiction or anything along the lines of what Malcolm has explored in her wonderful series of books, did this help you in any way? Or
I haven't read that much Janet Malcolm. I'm trying to think what I've read. I think I read one of the earlier ones, and then I've read a couple of the essays that were in the New Yorker. She's a very interesting writer. I mean, I think that I am influenced by nonfiction, maybe more so by Joan Didion or by Jeff Dyer's kind of experiments with self-consciousness are useful to me. And I really, I've been really fascinated by the poet Mary Ruffles, the stuff she's been doing, Lectures I Will Never Give, and that kind of crossover. Oh, and Anne Carson, who knows what she's writing in Plain Water? I mean, is it essays? Is it? But that sort of that use of facts and things was interesting to me. But I love to read nonfiction. I'm glad I'm not a nonfiction writer. And whenever I try to write nonfiction, I really can't. Because I want to play around with things too much. But I love that. I love the freedom to move essayistically. I think that's something that as a fiction writer you would want to have in your toolkit.
Do you feel perhaps self-conscious that the rules of nonfiction dictate in some sense to a depiction of the facts, and that the minute that you fudge out of that territory, you get into the lyrical essay mode that has been of some controversy in right. recent years.
Right. Well, I have that. I have that. Is it John DeGatta?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's all the same page, right? I have those books. And I mean, the lyric essay, that feels like it has one of those names that it's just going to get pounded down because of its name
oh, yeah.
alone.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a terrible
it's a
term
terrible name,
itself,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sort of like, it's like creative nonfiction, you know, just something
exactly.
where you're like, oh, don't say that. But
or a nonfiction novel or something.
I mean, I think that is a very, I think the people that I know that write really interesting nonfiction, nobody feels like that's the way they have to write it, where it's this absolute loyalty. I think that's like an old school kind of journalistic thing. But a lot of people who read and review books are still like that about it. And there's a weird game of gotcha. The novelist version of it is people like saying, oh, this detail is autobiographical. So is this person
yeah.
this person? I mean, that's the version of kind of literalness that happens to fiction writers. And I think to nonfiction writers, it's about, were you faithful to the facts?
Yeah. Whereas the fiction writer has to deal with the burden of constantly answering, oh, well, yeah, this kind of happened to me,
right.
although it didn't.
Right.
And that's kind of misses the point, because the reader is being asked to believe in lies, and so therefore
right.
any representation of a truth that is transmuted into fiction is going to be a lie, so it shouldn't actually matter.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter, but it's a sort. I think it's also partly because sometimes people just don't know how to approach talking about fiction, and
yeah.
that's the sort of gossipy way in, I guess. And so it feels easier. And I think that it's hard in some ways. If you write something well enough, then the parts that are invented out of whole cloth and the parts that you've drawn on from your own experience or someone close to you, they should feel seamless.
Yes.
So it's funny as a writer if people come up to you and are particularly upset about something in your book that you're just like, okay, it's not you, first of all, and it didn't happen, but you can, you know, and then the other things that are just like passing by that you would think they would know were taken from the Thanksgiving dinner, you know, nobody's noticing.
There's also the question of temperament attached to character. It must match that of the writer.
Mm-hmm.
Do quotes, whether they be real or invented, mm-hmm. actually allow you to beat that rap, so to speak?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Maybe, yeah, that might be the kind of squirm out. I think that it's more just that like half my brain is made up of quotes. You know, I'm the daughter of two English teachers, and I'm a pretty obsessive reader, and I teach now for many years, and so a lot of that just it swirls around in my head. And this, I was trying very much so in this novel to capture a more kind of diffuse consciousness. And so that meant that things flowed in and things flowed out.
There's another thing I feel compelled to bring up, which I was really interested in this book. There's one point where the wife asks her daughter, would you like to be a doctor when you grow up? And the daughter replies, I'm already a doctor. We become very aware at that moment of the word daughter, because if you actually harden the GH, it's going to be doctor.
That's
so
great.
I wanted to ask you about how this book often reveals the risk of getting stuck in the wrong regions of a book. You have the husband who reads the copyright page to the daughter during story time. You have
mm-hmm.
the wife getting stuck in Freud's index.
Mm-hmm.
I firmly believe that a gaffe is a creative possibility, a
mm-hmm.
joyful possibility.
Mm-hmm.
If you mishear a word or a phrase, it could lead you down an entirely different rabbit hole, and it's magnificent. I'm wondering, you know, why do you think the wife expresses trepidation sometimes in expressing this pursuit? I mean, was the idea here to explore permanent anguish, the kind of terrible existence which you're just walking around with dead and joyless eyes,
mm-hmm.
as the observed dead souls are in this book? Is this something that cripples the explorative possibility? I'm curious.
Okay, I think I got the first part. I think I might have lost the second part, but I'll try to address
sure.
it from the beginning.
That's a big question, I know.
I think that as a writer, I love to fall into seeming mistakes. I'm totally with Joyce about, you know, mistakes being portals of discovery.
Yes.
And almost all the writers that I really admire, they...
Or a genius never makes mistakes.
Right, right. I mean, I believe that, I call it like my writing brain, but my writing brain is my intuitive brain is much, much smarter than my analytical brain when it comes to what should be on the page. So I like that. I mean, I think that if there's trepidation, if anything, I think that the character of the wife does believe in that. And one of the reasons she's so, finds kind of middle-aged life so stultifying is that she feels like the possibilities have narrowed and not that many people are even referring to that. I mean, someone else could say, well, let's not call this a wrong turn. Let's not call this a mistake. Let's like reinvent this life so that it's interesting.
Yes.
Even within these confines. You know, I'm someone who loves, my first, you know, teacher who was a real mentor to me was, Gil Sorrentino, and he gave us the idea of generative devices,
yes.
You know, and so I kind of love it whenever there are constraints and there are things. So I think she's constrained by what is just prescribed ideas about what a wife or a mother is, and she feels like I want to break out of them, and I think that actually creates some good energy in the book, and then she does start breaking out of it.
Yeah. But do you think a lot of that is informed by her permanent sense of anguish? The whole idea of mistakes as portals of discovery and all that.
I don't even know if she has a permanent sense of anguish. I think she has a permanent sense of loneliness, which is a little different. I think that the wife, and this is why there's so many passages about this, I remember I was reading something and I thought to myself, oh, so interesting. Like really this just comes up again and again in every mystic teaching and philosophy, you know, the question just keeps being asked, like, are you awake? And then the next question is, why are you not awake? So this idea of being awake to the world around you is very important to the wife and very important to her, not only as a writer, but, you know, as a wife and as a mother. And she feels very lost when she loses that and when she starts to sleepwalk. But being awake to the world also means that you're porous and everything comes through. And it's not a very easy way to live.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think it can feel like permanent anguish. I mean, she doesn't think of it that way. So I think that's what the momentum is there. Like, how can she stay awake? And how can she feel like she's paying attention to the world around her and not just following along the road of received ideas she already has.
On the other hand, she is quite willing to look at the world as one that is populated by people with dead eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is absolutely fascinating that her ability to try to divagate through all of this is prohibited by the fact that, well, maybe you may see dead eyes, but do you see beyond those eyes?
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, why that was a concern. I mean, it seems to me, from a reading standpoint at least, that a lot of this has to do with anxieties of getting older,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the fact that it actually matches, the fact that when she stops dyeing her hair and she mm-hmm. just kind of embraces who she is,
mm-hmm.
It becomes less of an observation that she notes. But I am curious as to the idea of the whole dead eyes and also the many circles and the sun that's always peering through the window.
Mm-hmm.
Why that brightness is such a qualifier for her worldview?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as the book moves on, the movement that I was trying to show was that she starts out. She's very judgmental, and she has very much an idea of what people are like in the world, and her own experience is you know, laughably narrow.
Yeah.
But I think this is true of many people when they are trying to make some kind of art. You develop your aesthetic at first in opposition to things, and at first, like the telling yourself that you can do this is because other people are not doing it. But as the book goes on, I mean, the trope I use is that she makes fun of people doing yoga and then
yes.
she finds herself doing it at the end and realizing that that the woman who's teaching her is actually, you know, kind of radiates some kind of quality that she wishes she had. But there's a line that I have later on in the book which to me is about how the wife is coming out of that, and it says that she used to make fun of people for this and that, but maybe the truth of getting older is that there are less and less things to make fun of until finally there's nothing you're sure you will never be, which can sound like a negative line to me, but is actually a line about taking your place among the human race and realize it's a humbling line. Like, actually, there's so, as I've gotten older, I found that so many people that I would have thought to myself, oh, we don't have very much in common, turn out to be people that have completely interesting things to say to me, and I'm learning how much more fun it is to listen than to need to put out there what I'm like.
Sure. I mean, and this kind of also relates to the notion of Kummerspec, which is in the book. It's referenced. It's this idea, of course, in Germany that, you know, emotional overeating results in excess weight. But near the end of the book, she does remark that she has lost weight at the yoga class. And I find that to be quite interesting. The scrim has fallen away. The book itself here is svelte. And so I'm wondering, you know, if it's really sort of excess weight that she's dealing with more so than some of these other ideas of self-consciousness. Or maybe the self-consciousness kind of informs...
excess weight. I mean, do you mean that literally? Or do you mean that in a more metaphorical sense?
More of a metaphor. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think that there's a sense throughout the book that, at least that I was trying to create, of things falling away. And that feeling of suddenly there isn't anything beneath your feet anymore. And of course, that's a terrifying feeling. And most of us have experienced it in some way or another. But it's also suddenly you're in space. And there's something about that is sublime and terrifying. And you're certainly not asleep when that's happening. And so there is a sense of like things dropping away, whether that's the weight of her preconceived ideas, whether that's in some ways her, delusional, grandiose ideas of herself, which she sort of jokes about, you know, the wishing to be a genius, the wishing to be someone whose name will be on a postage stamp and et cetera.
Let's talk about space, specifically the apartment, which is populated by mice and lice. This is very interesting because we have a living space that is known in this book for how it is infested, as opposed to the layout, which I find really interesting. Later in the book, you have some invented proverbs about insects. One insect is enough to fill a country. Even an insect 1/10 of an inch long has 5/10 of a soul. If we accept the notion that words are insects, as many people have said, I mean, why should the living space around us likewise be defined by this idea? How can the golden record, which you bring up from Voyager, even with its expressive prohibitions against the human body, work as an ideal for both books and life?
Well, I didn't actually make up those proverbs, by the way.
Oh, you didn't?
No. They're listed as proverbs. but I think that the idea sort of that their apartment is kind of teeming with life, but that she's seeing it as kind of incursions. Part of what I was trying to get there is that I think often when people have their own family, there can be this sort of retreat, this like circling of the wagons, and that's what she says, a home is a place with a perimeter and you can keep people out. And so one of the things that I think I was just kind of amusing myself as a writer was to keep bringing things in, whether it was the mice or the lice or the Jehovah's Witnesses outside the door, just to kind of, it's a very false idea we have that when we're inside these four walls, we're somehow no longer a part of anything bigger than ourselves.
Clutter is inevitable.
Right, yeah. Right. And so that's part of, I really wanted to show her closing down and going farther and farther into herself. And then just as I do something with the form and the point of view, and then I wanted to open it back out a little bit spatially. So I thought a lot in terms of space in this book, in terms of visual space, the white space. I was thinking a lot about how visual artists think of negative space and how that can be just as important in something. And I feel like it's a little underutilized in novels, like that feeling of what's not there is informing the thing that you just said and is maybe making it much more emotionally charged.
Yeah. Well, it's basically Hemingway's iceberg theory, essentially.
Exactly.
Except in a fragmentary form.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, that seems a good place to stop, because I know you have to catch a train. But Jenny, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic. Okay.